She's going to present her paper on factory employment and fertility decisions, field experimental evidence from Ethiopia. Thank you. So you have about 45 minutes, and then we have about 15 minutes for discussion.
Great. First, thank you very much for inviting me, and I really appreciate the opportunity to present my work here. So as Simone said, this talk is about factory employment and fertility decisions in Ethiopia, and where we use a field experiment to look at this relationship. I have to say already, this is a work in progress, and I really appreciate any questions or comments you have. And you can also ask me during the talk, I don't mind. Okay, but the motivation behind this study is that industrialization has potentially large impacts on several developmental outcomes, such as economic growth and trade, job creation, and poverty reduction. And if we look at the manufacturing industry in particular, the jobs created there typically hire a lot of women. And by increasing the female labor force participation, we might have some additional developmental impacts, such as increasing women's income. Maybe it can also affect fertility decisions. And also, maybe this industrialization can be a driver for women's empowerment. Now we'll talk about all of these three. So there is a growing, small but growing literature on the impacts of increased female labor force opportunities and participation in the manufacturing industries in developing countries. So most of these papers do find quite positive impacts on women's lives. So it is found that these labor opportunities, they increase women's reproductive health. So they marry later. They also get their first child later. Also, women who work in these industries typically have children who are more healthy. They also invest more in their children's education. And they're also more, they have more autonomy and they have more decision-making power. There have also been found some negative effects from these labor opportunities. So Blackman and Durkan here, they find that the women who work in these industries incur more serious health issues. Another thing is Heath and Kagi also find evidence of increased intimate partner violence in these industries. There's also a literature on female employment, not in the manufacturing industry, but on fertility and empowerment. And then empowerment is typically measured as decision-making power in the household. And in general, when women start working outside the home, when they bring home money, it's positive effects, both on decision-making power, but also on reducing fertility rates. The thing about investigating this relationship, this women employment and different outcomes such as fertility and empowerment, it's kind of tricky due to this endogeneity. So you have the reverse causality problem, and you also have the selection bias. So most of these papers that I have listed here use some kind of instrument variable, where the identification is proximity to a factory or to these labor opportunities. There are two papers here that use an experimental approach to investigate the impacts of female employment. And this is Blackman and Durkan, 2018, and the Jensen, 2012 paper. And I'm sure that many of you already know these papers, but if you don't, or if you need a reminder, I will just tell you shortly about them so that you can see more clearly the contribution of our paper as well. So the QG Jensen paper, 2012, in his paper, he randomizes recruitment services to young women in the BPO, so the business process outsourcing industry, by villages in India. And these kind of jobs are quite white-collar jobs, where you do need some education, you do need a proficiency in English. So these are quite different from these manufacturing jobs. But he finds that in the villages where they had this recruitment service, there were much more higher female labor supply in this industry or in this sector. There was also more women in post-school training. Women married later. They had their first childbearing at a later age. They also increased their aspirations for careers. So kind of they had in their mind that they wanted to continue working throughout their lives. And also families in these villages who had children and girls who were younger than the working age, they invested more in this. So the girls in these villages were more healthy and also were more likely to be enrolled in school. The other paper by Blattmann and Durkan, this is much closer to our study, both in terms of the method and also the country context. So in their study, they randomize entry-level applicants in the manufacturing and the farm industry in Ethiopia. So they randomize them into either they get a job into the factory or the firm that they applied to, or they get invited to participate in an entrepreneurship program or to a control group. In their paper, which is not like the other papers, they actually find quite bad outcomes from these manufacturing jobs. So 1 year later, most of them, 77%, had already quit the job. There were no differences in employment or in income between the ones who got the job and the ones who were in the control group. They found actually that the entrepreneurial program provided much better outcome for these women, so both by raising their earnings and also providing more steady working hours. But their paper only includes like 5 industrial firms, all around or close to Addis Ababa. And they do not look at fertility or this household decision-making power as we do.
So one clarification, Jensen,
yes.
I think, introduced an information campaign about possibility, right? Is that
yes.
an information campaign?
No, it was also recruitment service. So they helped them, so they informed about these jobs, but they also helped them a bit on the process, how to apply and all this. Right. Okay, so the contribution of our paper is then that this is the first study that look at the effects of employment on fertility by randomization on the individual level. By using an experimental design, it has 2 main benefits. One is that we are able to kind of circumvent this problems of endogeneity. And the other thing is that by having this design, we can really design the survey ourselves, and we can really dig into the mechanisms on an individual level and really see what happened with these women. We also have a different and a larger geographical area than the other studies. And another thing that we do to differentiate ourselves, that we chose to only look at a selected sample. So we only look at the married women of these workers. And there were 2 reasons for this. One, because we were mostly interested in this intra-household dynamics. So decision-making power, fertility. We also have a paper on intimate partner violence. So in order to increase our power, we only look at the married women. Another thing is that this is also a group that is interesting for policy makers. So you have the, if you want to increase women's income and employment, you want to increase women's empowerment, and also maybe you want to decrease fertility. Well, one way of doing that is education, we know that from the literature. But what about these women who have passed schooling age and they are already married? What could work on them? And then these kind of jobs could be one way. So we will have a look at that and see if there is an effect. So a little bit more on this female labor supply and fertility relation. Why is this so interesting? First of all, this relationship has a long tradition in economics. It started in the 60s and 70s. And the relationship is typically, the correlation is typically negative. But the causal relationship between labor supply and fertility is not really clear. It can go either way, or it could also be just a spurious correlation. So theoretically, we think about there's three channels or three effects. So when a woman starts working, you have an income effect. You have more income for the household. And in economics, we would consider children as a normal good. So that means more income, more children. But at the same time, as with other durable goods, that when your income is higher, you also shift your preferences to, you want more quality. So you would spend more on each child, on education, on health, and on food. So that means that each child becomes more expensive. So then when your income increases, then maybe your demand will then go down. So it's not really clear. This is a quantity-quality trade-off modeled by Becker. And then it's the substitution effect, which is more that when there are more labor opportunities, when the market wage increases for women, it is more expensive for her to stay at home. So the opportunity cost of staying at home becomes higher, and that would predict that you would have a lower, you would decrease the demand for children. However, this would be only relevant in the case where having a job and having many children is kind of incompatible. And then there's the empowerment effect, which is more like an intermediate channel. So both the empirical and also the theoretical literature would state that when women start working outside the home and also bringing more money to the table, would increase her decision-making power. And in a lot of countries, especially sub-Saharan Africa, women typically want fewer children than what men want. So if by increasing women's empowerment, maybe then the demand for the household demand for children would then be closer to the wife's preferences. Okay, and then there's also, so both the theoretical and empirical literature on this relationship is typically based on industrial country contexts. So in developing countries, these channels might be stronger or weaker or not even existent. So for example, in developing countries, jobs are typically often more compatible with childcare. So self-employment or farm work, you can just have the baby on your back. Or you also have more closer networks allowing for responsibility sharing of childcare. So when the mother is off at work, there are grandparents and neighbors and siblings who can take care of the children more easily. Also, preference for children might differ a lot between different contexts. So in sub-Saharan Africa, the actual fertility rate is more than twice as high as the world average, and this also reflects the difference in wanted fertility rates. And also, lastly, maybe access to contraceptives are limited in many developing countries, making it difficult to get the number of children that you actually prefer. Okay, so the context of this study is Ethiopia, So I'll just give a very brief some descriptors about the context before I explain the experimental design. So the first graph here, both of these figures are from the Ethiopian DHS in 2016. And what I wanted to show with the first one here is that we see that the employment status of women is really low in both the urban and rural areas. And this is kind of to demonstrate that what we are looking at in this study is that these are areas where very few, especially women, are working or have a formal job. And then suddenly there is this factory coming with lots of jobs. So it's really this effect of getting a job or nothing. And then it's on the fertility rates. So in Ethiopia in 2016, the total fertility rate was 4.6 children per woman. This is very high, although it has been declining over the years. It's still quite high on a relative to world averages. And also we see that the total fertility rate, total wanted fertility rate by women, it's lower than the actual fertility rate. And this has also been declining, but so women want less children than they actually get in Ethiopia. Okay, and then just a quick on the manufacturing industry in Ethiopia. So Ethiopia has this vision. So in 2025, they are going to be a middle-income country, and they are going to be the top, a top light manufacturing hub by 2025. So industrialization and manufacturing really plays a role of getting to this goal. And since 2004, Ethiopia has experienced a really impressive high economic growth, averaging at 10.6 GDP growth annually. And the manufacturing sector's added value as a share of GDP has remained relatively stable at around 4%. And although the government had hoped that that the manufacturing value added would be a bit higher, it's still significant. So in 2016-17, only in the manufacturing industry, 1.7 million jobs were created. So this is an industry in rapid growth, where lots of things are happening. Okay, so let's look at the design. So we are working with 30 medium and large factories in five different regions in Ethiopia. These factories are, some are Ethiopian owned, but there are also, most of them are also foreign owned. China, Korea, Bangladesh mostly. Most of these factories are in these industrial hubs or these industrial zones or very close to them, and I have showed here on the map where they are located. So the design of the experiment is like this. So all of these factories are factories who are either just starting up or they are expanding their production line. So they are in the need of employing a lot of people at a short time. So the applicants, in order to apply for these jobs, they need to meet, they need to come to the factory on a certain day, and bring their documents, and then the factories will do this a screening of who are the eligible ones. So some of them have some formal requirements, like you need to have completed 8th grade or 9th grade, 10th grade. And some of them have also some informal tests. So, for example, you are asked to sew on a line, or thread a needle, for example. When they have done this, and then our enumerators will also be there on that day. So they give us the list over all the eligible women and also the ones who are married. So then we invite these women and ask them, okay, do you want to be on this survey and this study with us? There's not enough jobs for everyone. That is clear from the beginning. So we tell them, okay, there will be a lottery. And you have about 50% chance of winning. And if you win, you will get offered a job in this factory that you applied for. And
so what is the kind of skill requirement for these jobs?
Not really any. Some of them have that you need to show that you can sew. Some of them have you need to have passed eighth grade. Other than that,
so
not really any.
Questions later on? Or?
I mean, if it's for understanding, you can ask now. If
okay.
It's more discussion, maybe at the end.
Okay. So we started with a sample size of 1,460 by the first follow-up. So the first follow-up is about half a year later, and we had 16% attrition. And the second follow-up, I will show the results from that, but we are still collecting the data. So I don't know about the attrition yet, and 800 is all the data I have. But the balance is the sample is balanced, and there's no difference in attrition by the different groups. So here's just the baseline, so the timeline of the data collection. So we used almost 2 years just to collect the baseline data, and then between baseline and follow-up is about half a year, and then it's about 1 year till the second follow-up. We also have a third one that we are collecting. Okay, a little bit more about the factories. Medium and large, most of them are in textiles, apparel, shoes, cosmetics, and plastics, and like they make some toys. The starting monthly wage in 2016 was 600 to 680 Ethiopian birr, and this is not sufficient living wages in Ethiopia. So just like for a comparison, the women, they also stated that their husband's monthly wage at baseline. And the average there was like 2,600 Ethiopian birr. This is also low for Ethiopian standards, but it's still four times higher than what the factories are offering. And the jobs were typically like floor workers. Okay. The sample, most of them were 24 years old, had 9.3 years of education, 93% of them were married, by construction, and the last 7% were living with a partner. Almost 70% of them had already at least one child, and the wanted lifetime fertility is 4 children. So we asked them, so if you could go back in time, before you had any children, how many children would you like to have in your lifetime? By looking at the income, the last 12 months before baseline, there was no difference in either the respondent's income or in the husband's income. And there's also no difference in whether they had a job before. And about 30% of them had ever had a job before. So most of these women were new to the formal labor market. Okay, so the estimation strategy, it is an experiment. So we use an intention to treat. Where T is here is treatment status, X is a set of baseline covariates. So we have this pregnant at baseline, age, religion, education, number of household members, income, whether they had a job, and also how many children they wanted. We also have this B is a block fixed effect. So it's kind of the each time we did the randomization. We do find that quite many, they were offered a job, they didn't take it up, or they quit. And also some in the control group also started working. So in order to account for this non-compliance, we also estimate this local average treatment effect. By using the lottery or the randomization as an instrument for having had any formal job since baseline. So the first set of results look at the income and the employment. So if we look at the first column, we see that the ones in the treatment group were like 46 percentage points more likely to actually start working in the factory that they applied to. But we also see that there are some in the control group who started, and most probably they started a bit later. By the first follow-up, about 25 plus 10, so about 40% of the ones in the treatment group were still working in the factory. They were also more likely to have any type of job. And the total income in the treatment group were about 40% higher than in the control group. This is actually considerably high, taking into account that so many of them didn't even start working and so many of them quit as well. When looking at the second follow-up, the effects are still quite strong, although a bit smaller. And it's also the ones who were still working there at the first follow-up. We do have a lot of people who quit between the baseline and the first follow-up. But from the first follow-up to the second follow-up, most of them stayed. So if you first stayed 6 months, then you were likely to stay even a year.
Sorry, I'm trying to clarify something here. So the treatment condition is 50% of the women who qualify, they get the job. So that's the treatment condition.
Yes.
So the treatment effect here then suggests the start. So out of the 50% of women who were offered the job,
mm-hmm.
55% did not take it up. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Why did they not take it up?
Well,
they were there to get the job.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's. I think it is that they applied for the job, but they didn't really know about the conditions. So as I told you, the wage was very low. So maybe they just found out that, no, it's not worth it.
But the wage was higher than some standard, typical wage in that part of the world. Is that right? Did you say something to that effect? No.
It is very low. It is a little bit higher than the minimum wage, but it's still very low.
Are there some stigma associated with working in a factory, which is, are there some sort of things like those, or?
No, so we do have a question on that, and no, it doesn't seem like that. Okay, so as a little bit to your question, because here there is a lot of numbers and a bit difficult to see, so here's just like a tree over, like, what is their decisions, what do they do? So 50% were in the treatment group, and about 50% of them actually started working. And then we see that 6% of them said that, no, thank you, I don't want a job, and they found another job. But most of them who didn't start there, they just ended up not working at all. And also in the control group, so we see that very few of them actually found another job. So if they applied for this job, they didn't get it, so they ended up, most of them, just with no job. And then we see also the ones who started, about 35% of them quit before the first follow-up.
So how does a control group end up getting a factory job? Because they were not offered the job, right?
No, but maybe like a month later they had a new hiring, and we couldn't say that, no, you're not allowed because you are in the control group. Yeah. Okay, so this whole talk about fertility, let's look at the fertility outcomes. So the outcome variable is then, are you currently pregnant or have you given birth since the baseline? And we see that about 16% fall in this category at half a year after baseline. So that means that some of them were pregnant already at baseline. But there is no difference between the treatment and the control group. And the same could be said about the second follow-up. So this is then about 1 year, or even a little bit more than 1 year after baseline. And there's no difference between the ones who got the job and the ones who didn't. However, there is something that happens. There is some dynamics. So if we split this outcome variable by the ones who are currently pregnant at the time of the survey, and the ones who had already given birth, so they have a little baby at home. We see that the ones who were in the treatment group or the ones who did have a formal job are much more likely to be pregnant at that time. And I interpret this that although they do get pregnant at the same rate, kind of, they do it at a later point. So they do postpone the pregnancy if they got the job. Mm-hmm. We also hypothesize that if you get a job, maybe that will change your preferred fertility. So you get the job, you get income, and you think, oh, this is great, I have more income, but I don't have time to have children, so I think it's better to have two children instead of having four children. But nothing really happens here. Okay, so if we... what should we really expect? As I said earlier, the theoretical predictions is not really clear. Should we expect more children or less children or no effects? So just by looking at like correlations at baseline, we see a quite strong positive effect of total household income and the number of children. So richer households have more children. But the thing is, if we split the income by the wife and the husband, we see that this positive effect, or not effect, but this positive correlation, is mostly driven by the husband's income, while the wife's is actually a bit negative. So from these graphs, it's still not really certain whether we should expect, because although it was negative for the women, it still increases the household income, so maybe it's positive, so it's not really clear yet. If we look at the substitution channel, so I said that the starting salary was like 600 bid. After they worked for some time, they got a bit higher salary, so 1,000 bid was the median monthly salary. And so at baseline, the total household income was like 2,600 Ethiopian bid, and one third of them didn't have a job at all. So an extra income of 1,000 bid would be a considerable contribution to the household income. So just by looking at this, you would think that staying at home is very, like, the opportunity cost is really high. Which would mean that these job opportunities would then mean decreasing demand for children. However, if we look at 30% of them had a job before, and the wage that they had at that job is not correlated with the number of children they had at all. So from this, it doesn't seem like there's any effect on the substitution channel or a correlation. Okay. So
are you able to? 55% of the women did not take up the job, and are you able to follow them up as well? Do you have information on them as well in your ITT estimates?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, we have 16% attrition, but that doesn't really correlate with whether they are working or not.
So you go back to their family home and then you interview them?
Yeah. Okay. The last set of results I want to show you is on household decision-making power, which is a proxy for empowerment. And here we had 15 questions on different household decisions, such as what to do if a child falls sick, whether to have children, but also like whether to earn money outside the house, and what to do with the wife's income, all this. So each of these decisions is coded as a dummy. So one, if she said that she's the main decision maker or that she has a lot of input to this decision. The first dot here is an index over all these decisions. And as we see that there's no effect of getting this job on any of the decisions. neither on the second follow-up. And this is actually quite surprising because in the literature on this women's earned income and decision-making power, it's typically typically quite positive, but in our context, it didn't seem to matter much. Okay, so just a summary. We find that female entry-level applicants who were randomly assigned to receive a job offer earned on average 42% more, 42% higher income that, after 6 months, and about 13% higher income after 1 year. There's no differences in fertility by treatment group. However, it seems like the treatment group seems postpone their pregnancies a few months. But there's no difference in wanted lifetime fertility or in household decision making. And also, just like theoretically, looking at the descriptive of the data, it's not really clear what we should expect and what would the long-term effects would be. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We still have quite a lot of time, like about 20 minutes for questions. Who would like to go first? Mila.
Yes, thanks for an interesting presentation. There was a lot of interesting things going on, and what I was thinking, the effect of the employment on fertility, that is just delaying a couple of months the decisions. Could it be that, did you think about the mechanism why this could happen? That could it also be that it's something that is not in the power of the women, that it's just like for biological reasons as well, that it starts is a bit stressful, so it somehow delays
for
that reason?
Whether it is intentional or biological or... I don't really know, but I will definitely try to figure out this. And I'm planning on doing some field work where I will do some interviews. So I will see if I can find more about this. Yeah.
And I have another comment.
Yeah.
So the decision-making power, you saw no change, really. Could you discuss or did you think about why is it? Is it because the work in the factory actually is not such an improvement to the situation elsewhere?
So my answer will just be on my hunch on what I find by looking at the data. And I think it's just that these jobs are they consider the jobs as temporary, short term. Doesn't really, it's not life changing at all, and therefore it also not really changes any of the dynamics in the family, because it's just this like something that they did for a few months.
Is that maybe the explanation for why you see different results from other countries? Because in some other countries there's it's a stepping stone at least to get to a higher position in the hierarchy, at least in that factory, and maybe even move on. At least that's my reading of some of the literature in some Asian countries.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard to trim that down, but we say you're going to talk more in the country with people. The other thing that got to my mind was childcare arrangements.
Yeah.
What type of childcare arrangements are typical there, and could that be an issue, actually? I don't have a hunch at all. Usually there's large family networks and there's possibilities, but it might be different in this case.
Yeah. When asking them about who takes care of the children that they have, or if they got a child, who would take care, they typically always state another family member.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Typically the mother of the respondent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to be a problem for them to find someone to take care of the children. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think this, because not only do they look at these jobs as temporary, but also there's not much opportunities of advancing in these jobs. You are at the floor, you might be like a floor manager, so that you're in charge of an assembly line, But other than that, it's not really more that you can achieve now.
How many go on to be assembly line manager?
I don't know, actually. No, I need to...
It's hard for you to run that
as
a proper econometric causality check, but just even to know how many move on would kind of feed maybe the story of is that maybe the lack of potential advancement.
Yeah, I will definitely check that out.
So maybe this idea that jobs might be temporary actually might be driving this fact that women decide to postpone just a little bit being pregnant, right?
Yeah.
Because for them it's just not coming back to, say, normal. And then I have two questions, or maybe two clarifications on two graphs that you showed before. One is that graph that was you were showing this correlation between wage and number of children desired.
Yeah.
So that was, if I'm not wrong, wage in the last job. And that was, on the other axis, there was the total number of children, so also the ones that the women had before.
Yes.
So probably this lack of correlation is also driven by the fact that, these women could have had these children before that way, that job.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So if you have information on previous jobs and how much more or less they earned, then you might.
Yeah, so this is what this shows, is like the salary of the last job that they had,
mm-hmm.
And how many children that they have, the actual
total
number.
Yeah.
But whether this job was something that they had for a long time or a short time, they don't really know
much
about that. Yeah.
And then a third point, a graph that you showed, I think, just before this slide, or two slides before. Yes, this one. So, for men, we see that it's increasing.
Yeah.
But for women, actually, it's declining. But what they see is like a polarized distribution a little bit. So for women that earn very low, then the desired number of children is very high. And then at the other extreme, then it's low. So there is like this gap in between. So it's more like if you want a U-shape type of field.
Yeah.
So either these women need to have like a very good job opportunities to reduce substantially their fertility, or for situations kind of in between and not well-paid jobs, that maybe would not be likely to change their fertility decision.
Yeah.
That might be, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It sounds possible.
So a couple of things. One is, I guess you do have information about the husband's income,
yeah.
Right? So are there heterogeneities of the treatment effect when you interact with the husband's income? Because that's where the power difference really starts kicking in, or that's one way of proxying for the power difference in the family.
Yeah, I haven't run that.
I don't know if you have enough power to run that test.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at interactions and then you often run out of power.
Yeah. The only thing that I can say is that just looking at descriptives, it looks like the ones who have a husband who earns more or better than the median, they are more likely to quit the job or not accept the job offer in the first place. Mm.
So then the control and, so I'm also interested in the 12% of the women who end up being in the factory anyway, in the control group. So it clearly means that they have, they are a selected group in some sense, right? Because they have higher motivation, more education, or something like that. So do you have power to compare the fertility choice of 12% of the people who, 12% of the women who end up being in the control group and compare them with the 50% or 45% of the women in the treatment group?
I don't know. I would definitely try to look maybe on the descriptives to just see, but I don't really know if I can really say anything about that, because then you don't have this randomization anymore. So
you
then
don't have the randomization. So
so
control minus that 12%, compare that.
Okay,
so then you're So that's an appropriate comparison.
Yeah, yeah, it would be. Yeah, I will do that. Yeah. Thanks for the suggestion.
So do you know how those two graphs actually fit together? Like, is it women that have a husband with a higher income has less need to earn an additional income? And as you said, they are more likely to quit the job. So is this, like, this lower earning women
the same as
these
husbands?
Like, do they kind of belong together? Or?
I would believe so.
Okay.
But I haven't really looked at that.
But if you show the same thing by share of wife's income out of household income, you could even think about per capita income could be another maybe revealing graph, actually.
Yeah.
And it's quite surprising that, I mean, you would think normally that at some point of income, the number of children goes down again. I don't know whether this is because we are at the lower income spectrum in any case, because it's people applying for this type of low-skilled jobs, or whether, like, what this would be like if you were just looking at a normal national representative survey, like whether what would be the typical pattern in the country there, and how different is it from this group?
Yeah,
kind of, maybe just something to consider.
Actually, because I do find this graph quite surprising. Actually,
exactly.
Yeah.
Do you also have information on the job status of their husbands, like the sector where their husbands work? Like, if there are substantial differences between women who have their husband working also in factories versus women who have their husband working in the traditional agricultural sector, or informal or unemployed, or especially for implications for this bargaining power.
Yeah, we do have data on that, actually.
You had a question, David?
Yeah, it's the same thing, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe I just clarify one thing. Yeah, it's during the experimental design, you have the control and the treatment, and then for those treatment, you have those who take up the job, and then those who don't, and then these people who don't take the job, they would apply again in the future? Or do you have that information?
Not directly. We do ask, like, how many jobs have you applied for? But we don't really ask, have you applied for this job again? So no, I don't actually know. But
because otherwise, yes, we have. I think when I think about the job assignment, when I look at the randomization result, and I thought that, okay, maybe we have these three heterogeneity in the treatment. First, those who would given a job and then take it out. Those who had given a job, but then they don't take up, but they would take in the near future. And those who don't get the treatment, but then they would again apply for the job in the future. So I think in that case, I don't know if you would incorporate this into the design. I don't know.
I think we account for it a little bit, at least when we look at the local average, the late estimates. Other than that, we can't really. But I would think that in the average, this kind of would disappear when just looking at the intention to treat. But yeah, of course, it cannot be perfect. You cannot, we couldn't say to the factories that, oh, here's a list, you don't hire them in the future. That wouldn't really be ethical, I think.
I don't do experiments, I'm not an experiment, but what are the policy implications of such a study?
Yeah, so
you did talk about if you could give a very detailed answer.
Yeah. So the policy implications for now would be that So this women's empowerment and also fertility has been an argument for also why these kind of jobs would benefit women in general and also the country and the economy. So my results just show that no, there's no effect really on the lives of these women of getting these jobs. So
you mean factory jobs, right?
Yes. So yes, it does increase the income for a short time, and that is of course very good, but on a larger welfare measure, it doesn't seem to be life changing for these women at least.
But this kind of job, what you did talk about, definitely will not bring about any life changing, you know, to these people.
Yeah.
Because I think it's more like a casual work, right? You said temporal.
Not necessarily. It is a permanent job that they get. It is regular hours, and it is a secure job. Why I said it was temporary is more in the minds of these workers.
And they have very, very low income as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That cannot transform their.
No, but this is kind of one of the big. Yeah. But this is often one of the big arguments for why industrialization is so good, because it creates stable jobs, it creates income, and it's a poverty, it fights poverty. But in this context, no, it doesn't seem to be such a big impact on the workers themselves. Maybe for the big economy, with more trade, international trade, foreign direct investments, but for the workers, it's not life changing.
Rachel, just to pick up on Michael's point, I guess when you first posed the question, I thought one thing you could respond, right, is that it's not jobs, but it's good jobs that matter to these outcomes.
Yeah.
But then, as you were talking, I realized that. You know, you've been describing these as temporary jobs, but actually they're not temporary jobs, they're permanent jobs, could be permanent jobs.
Yeah.
And I think if I remember right, these could be jobs that are about a third of the household income. So even if the wages are not that high, that's a pretty large share of the household income, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they are good jobs in some description, right?
Yeah.
But I think it would be helpful maybe to have a bit more clarity about that temporary. And also about what share of the household income it is. I mean, even if the amount is low, if it's a large share of the household income, it should be, we would expect it to have a significant effect on what's happening in decision-making.
Yes.
Just following up on Rachel's point, you mentioned the study by Blattmann and Durkin, and I think your results basically also reflect what they found for the industry factory workers, right?
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, you said that in comparison, those that were given this entrepreneurship training, or I don't know what exactly was intervention, this had better results. And in theory, you would think that this kind of rather self-employed, probably informal jobs are less secure and less likely to be good jobs compared to this kind of you get a full permanent work contract. And
yeah.
I don't know, do they provide any argument or reason of why they find this? Is there anything?
It was more about the working hours, but they had like the freedom to choose themselves. These jobs, they typically work 6 days a week, very long hours. It's typically mandatory overtime. When we ask them, so why did you quit? Most of them say it's the salary or the working hours. Also, quite many of them, like 20% of the ones who quit, say that they got sick from the job. So it really really reflects that these are not good jobs.
Maybe have time for a last
question. I have
question.
A quick question.
Yeah.
Is women's work stigmatized in certain income level or educational level? Can you look into that? Like, if certain women are not going into the jobs, why aren't they going? Is it based on not just the partner's income, but their education, or is it stigmatized, women working in general?
In our sample, one asked about stigmatization. In general, they say that it's positive when a woman works outside the home and brings an income for the family. Of course, this we only look at the women who all of them have applied for the job, so they are maybe different from other households where it wasn't even a question whether she should work or not, right? On the education, so most of them have either 8th or 10th grade completed. And I do see a little bit that also the ones who are offered and start, they typically have a little bit higher education than the ones who choose not to start. And my impression is that it is reflected in the salary, in the wage. So the ones who have a little bit more education, they also get a higher wage. So for them, it might be more worth it to actually work here.
And the ones who keep the job are on average more educated or less educated than the ones who stay?
Not very strong, but slightly, yeah.
Says no further question, and thanks a lot for a very interesting presentation, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much.